Petros Dermatosyan, Armenia, Artsakh, and Azerbaijan. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. Again, that's 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. So Israel joins with Turkey and Azerbaijan in denying what is often called the first state-directed genocide of the 20th century. It's more than ironic that two peoples, the Armenians and the Jewish people, were subjected to genocide. Now, you've edited a new book called Denial of Genocide in the 21st Century. Talk about the Armenian genocide and how it intersects and reverberates today with Armenians and others around the world.
It's a comparative study on denial of genocides in general in the 21st century. And I chose 7 to 8 cases of genocide denial that includes but are not limited to the Armenian genocide, to the Holocaust, to the Cambodian genocide, to the Guatemalan genocide, to the Bosnian genocide, to the Rwandan genocide, and to the crimes of genocide perpetrated by the Assad regime against his own citizens. The idea was to see what and how denial has changed in the 21st century with the introduction of social network, of court cases, bringing people to court when you start using the word genocide, using the medium of academic presses in order to promote genocide denial. They say that genocide denial is the last step of Gregory Stanton, for example, has 10 stages of genocide. The last stage is denial. But I argue that denial is not the last stage. Denial is the first stage, because when you are committing to genocide, you're also denying it through your propaganda, through your extensive diplomatic networks of showing that this is not the case. Look at these images, fabricated images. And we see this happening in all cases of genocide. The Armenian, I've dedicated 3 chapters to the Armenian genocide. And people would ask why the Armenian genocide has 3 chapters and Rwanda has 1, etc. It's simply because the Armenian genocide is the only genocide that has a state sponsoring its denial, the state spending millions of dollars to deny the Armenian genocide through lobbying and through using its all networks, all diplomatic networks, whether these are the embassies, the consulates, cultural centers around the globe, student unions, associations, everything that has any connection would become part of this denial networks. And of course, the orders go from this ministry, from the cabinet, to the diplomatic staff, and it eventually goes down to the just one person who is either an attaché of culture attaché or a person who's working in the university or students, etc. So Turkey, until today, denies the fact that the genocide has taken place. It spends millions of dollars, and we see that today the denial of genocide has also taken place, is taking new heights in all denials of genocides due to the rise of right-wing governments, whether it's under Trump, whether it's under Orban, whether it's under Erdogan, whether it's under all types of right-wing governments. There is denial, there is Islamophobia, there is anti-Semitism, and all of this are part of the 21st century. I was talking today in my human rights class who's saying that people thought that with the collapse of the Soviet Union, the Western liberalism triumphed and everyone was going to, you know, become democratic. But that's not the case. We see much more violations in human rights record in the 21st century than in the end of the 20th century, not only by despotic governments, but by democratic governments too. So the aim of the book, Denial of Genocide in the 21st Century, to show the readers in a comparative perspective, an interdisciplinary perspective, the different methodologies, techniques used by denialists in order to deny the respective genocides of the 20th century, not only the 20th century, but also denial of the indigenous genocide in our own country here, in the United States, whereby you see certain policies passed by President Trump affecting the indigenous population, removal of sacred sites, and policies of marginalization of indigenous population. And people say, well, if you want to preach about the talk about the Armenian genocide, why shouldn't we talk about the indigenous genocide first in the United States? And that's right, because that's the most important aspect in this country, to go back to the history of the formation of this country and discuss about the injustices and the genocides that have been inflicted upon the native indigenous population.
Nikol Pashinyan is the Prime Minister of the Republic of Armenia, and it's fair to say he's between a rock and a hard place. There have been, subsequent to the catastrophe in Nagorno-Karabakh, Artsakh, demonstrations in Yerevan, the Republic's capital, calling for his ouster. Now, he made a slight pivot to the U.S. Recently when he allowed a few score U.S. troops to do training exercises with Armenian troops. I wonder if that ruffled Putin's feathers a bit. What do you think about his performance? And also comment on the significance of the Armenian parliament ratifying membership in the International Criminal Court.
You know, Pashinyan came into power and there was, you know, the euphoria of revolution. And as it happened in the Arab Spring, all of us were happy, etc. But soon the political situation changed in Armenia. And sometimes maybe opposition powers cannot be governments, you know. And to that extent, he did a lot of changes, I would think, specifically dealing with oligarchy in terms of foreign policy. The government has been weak. I think Pashinyan should have resigned when the war was lost in 2020. But he stayed in power. He stayed in power in order to continue what he sees as the democratic path of Armenia. The fear is that, as you said, between the hard place and the anvil, it's like either Pashinyan, it seems, or either the return of the ancien regime. And I call this ancien regime, the regime that has been filled by oligarchy who have good ties with Moscow. But this is an important thing, is that it's difficult, I would see that, how the government would act in this difficult situation. But realizing that, Pashinyan, realizing that Moscow is no more the same Moscow that used to be in the past protecting Armenian interests, Pashinyan started deviating more towards the West. He sent his wife to Ukraine to send gifts to the kids in Ukraine. He participated. He agreed for U.S. troops to participate. And by the way, these exercises were taking place along the years, and now it became much more dominant because of the tilting to the West. And eventually, now the last thing is ICC becoming part of ICC. All of this done intentionally to anger Russia. And people are angry in Armenia against Russia because Russia failed to fulfill its promises to protect Armenia. At the end of the day, there are Russian-Armenian alliance, military alliance. Russian troops are positioned in Armenia. And when you're part of the Collective Security Treaty Organization and you don't even help Armenia when its own land is being invaded, then it raises major question. Now, It's a difficult thing. I mean, tilting towards the West, what would the West bring to Armenians? I doubt that they're going to bring major change, help Armenians to rise, you know, to stand on its feet. We saw Samantha Power from USAID, the administrator, came to Armenia, brought $11.5 million. That was a token given to Armenians, and it was very ironic that, you know, we're tired of seeing humanitarian aid that comes ex post facto after events take place, just to show that United States is interested. I don't think United States is interested in Armenians. They're interested in the region. They want to have a foot in the region of the Caucasus and South Caucasus. And the worst thing that Armenia could become is another proxy center between the West and Russia with its acolytes such as Azerbaijan.
Samantha Power, incidentally, was Obama's ambassador to the United Nations, and she was completely silent on the question of recognition of the Armenian genocide, which is kind of ironic because you must be familiar with her book about genocide, which begins with the assassination of one of the principal architects of the genocide, Talat Pasha, on a street in Berlin. But let me talk to you about another architect of that 1915 Turkish genocide, Enver Pasha. There's a report that Azerbaijani soldiers have a shoulder patch with Enver's picture on it, celebrating him as a kind of a hero. I mean, should people be outraged and offended by this? Imagine if a German soldier had a picture of Hitler on his shoulder patch.
Those were part of the badge that the soldiers were wearing. The badge has the image of Enver Pasha on it, and there is a writing around the badge that says, Azerbaijani kaçma Ermeni sadece yorun öleceksin. Don't escape Armenia, you'll die of exhaustion. And there is the Enver Pasha in the middle. It's not that the badge only. Now, Azerbaijan also named one of the streets in Stepanakert in the name of Enver Pasha. So Azerbaijan's larger policy that it's presenting to the West is that we're trying Armenians to reintegrate the Azerbaijan society. I would really support that reintegration if Azerbaijan was Switzerland, if Azerbaijan was Denmark. But this is a despotic regime that has been indoctrinating its own population for 30 years with anti-Armenianism, Armenianism, and Armenophobia. Who would want to live in Artsakh under the Azerbaijani despotic regime? Today, above 100,000 Armenians were cleansed, ethnically cleansed, and they're in Armenia. How are you going to convince them to go back to their homes and live under Azerbaijan, where their children have been killed during the war, where their fathers have been killed, where their families have been maimed, where their grandmothers have been tortured? I mean, who would go and live there? That's why, for example, the biggest mistake that Pashinyan did, for example, he gave up on Nagorno-Karabakh.
He recognized the borders that it belonged to Azerbaijan. I was going to ask you about that. Why would he do that?
I don't know. I mean, whereas Azerbaijan did not recognize the territorial integrity of Armenia, which is 29,800 kilometers square, and Armenia recognized the territorial integrity of Azerbaijan. And that's why people are angry at the Pashinyan administration of how come you just sold the most important Armenian cause after the genocide, which is the Karabakh question. It could be he was under pressure. It could be he was thinking of that support is going to come from the West. He was thinking, or he was inept even to deal with the situation in Nagorno-Karabakh. Or maybe they told him, if you accept this, if you accept the territorial integrity, then it would prevent further aggression of Azerbaijan against the Republic of Armenia per se. But that didn't work. Recognizing or not recognizing. And what Russia is saying that now is that we can't do anything because Pashinyan has recognized the territorial integrity, which includes Nagorno-Karabakh.
Speaking of the refugees, the more than 100,000 that have fled Nagorno-Karabakh, Artsakh, their ancestral home, the current issue of The Guardian has a couple of the refugees saying, I'm quoting, "I will never go back. We are lost. We have no homes, nowhere to go." What happens now to the historic Armenian cultural treasures that are in Nagorno-Karabakh, Artsakh, now that Azerbaijan has full control?
I mean, ethnic cleansing is coupled also with cultural genocide. With the 2020 war, Azerbaijan has also destroyed many important monuments. And there's the erasing of churches, for example, you know, totally erasing of churches. And now Karabakh is not only, or Artsakh is not only an important Armenian, has important historic Armenian connection, but it has the first Armenian school in the monastery of Amaras, where Mesrop Mashtots, the person who, the saint who invented the Armenian letters, taught there. You have other major important monasteries and churches. What's the fate of this? Now, there is some rumors that the biggest church in Karabakh, which is in Shushi, Artsakh, is going to be turned into a mosque, you know. I haven't verified that. Maybe it's true, maybe it's not, but I wouldn't be surprised, you know. So the cultural legacy is in danger. But more importantly for me, I mean, there is a cultural genocide going on. More importantly is the living human beings. For them, their homeland is not Armenia. Those who were ethnically cleansed from Artsakh, their homeland is not Armenia. Their homeland is Artsakh. That's where they grew up. That's where they lived. That's where they got their education. That's there where, you know, worked on the lands as peasants, as industrialists, etc. So that's their homeland. And bringing them to Armenia, it's not like solving the question. It's like taking one group and sending them to another country. Or not bringing, but they being ethnically cleansed. But again, it's better than, if you think about that, at least they have somewhere to go. They were able to leave our ethnically cleansed, forcefully displaced, and go to move to Armenia. Otherwise, it would have been disastrous. There is no confidence, David, in the Azerbaijani authorities that they're going to allow Armenians to live in peace in the region if they come back. Of course, France today is trying to pass a resolution or something in the UN would entail allowing the Armenians to go back under international guarantees. That's also very suspicious, I think, because international community have failed the Armenians. What international guarantees are you going to establish in a despotic country? There is no such a thing as international guarantee in a despotic country where you have one family ruling.
Perhaps a harbinger of things to come in terms of these cultural treasures is what happened to the famous Armenian Khachkars in Nakhichevan. There's a local scholar here in the Denver area, Simon Marakyan, who has written about this, who has documented that these great cultural monuments have been desecrated and destroyed. Don't mind me saying, but Armenians have a tendency to engage in infighting, a lot of finger-pointing, instead of focusing on unity and coming together. How do you overcome that tendency?
Factionalism has always been a characteristic of Armenians, because they never had political entity, political progression. The last kingdom fell in 1375, Cilicia, and from 1375, the second experience of having an independence republic was in 2 years, and then they went under the Soviet regime. So lack of nationhood, first, lack of political experience, because whatever they had was Soviet political experience, which does not work in the post-Soviet period, I think. And factionalism is also part of the Armenian political system. David, the joke, two Armenians, three political parties, you know this joke, two Armenians, three political parties. And disunity has been the major foe for the Armenians, disunity, because you have different political parties, you have different interests. Armenians do not have the luxury to decide their own future unanimously. That's the problem. There is no overarching ideology or an objective that can bring Armenians to one under one umbrella. Maybe the genocide is the overarching common denominator that can bring Armenians under one umbrella. But besides that, I don't see a movement I mean, 1988, there was a national movement, which was strong. But then there was the earthquake, and then the First Karabakh War, etc. But there is no overarching identity, especially today, post-2020 war, that Armenia is ravaged by internal divisions. Some parties are catering Russian Federation. Others are catering Western interests. So I would say that Armenia has become a proxy place for international political agendas.
Well, where do you see U.S. and Armenia relations going? I'm sure Washington would love to have Armenia out of the Russian orbit and into its hegemonic configurations.
That's what the United States wants. I don't think that's going to happen. Again, with the presumption that we're not going to benefit anything from the West or Russia to that extent. As you said, you know, unity is the most important factor that can bring Armenians together and strengthen the infrastructure of the country, which has been shaken recently by the war. You know, you see what democracy brought to Armenia too. You know, the West always keeps bragging that other countries, Eastern countries, are not democratic. And when democracy prevails and the results come out, and then you are not helping them, and they're alone in that fight. And the neighborhood is a neighborhood of despotic regimes. You know, you have Azerbaijan, you have Russia, you have other places, you know. So
Turkey
has changed, you know, since Erdogan's arrival into power. With his, you know, neo-Ottomanism, maximalism, and his clout in North Africa, in Caucasus, in the Middle East, and other places. So from the U.S. perspective, they do want to mobilize Armenians to remove it from the CISTO organization, Collective Security Treaty Organization. But the major question, would Russia allow that to happen? Would it use again Azerbaijan or Turkey in order, quote-unquote, teach Armenia a lesson of not leaving, you know, not deviating from your path? Again, the real challenge would be if Armenia tells the Russian troops in Armenia, go home, you know. Would it dare to do something like that? Will it dare do something like that? So Armenia, again, doesn't have the luxury to play this game.
And finally, what gives you hope as you look to the future?
Hope is an important word. I think I'm a pessimist, but maybe my pessimism gives me more energy to work in order to try to bring hope. I'm not a fighter. I'm not a diplomat. I'm not a politician. I'm a scholar, and the path that I have is scholarship, publishing as much as I can in order to raise awareness about injustices that have taken place against Armenians in the course of centuries, whether it's in the Armenian genocide, whether it's today's condition. But also I teach about comparative genocide. I teach about Palestinian history, about the conflict. I teach also about human rights. So my idea is that justice should be also dealt in general with all types of human rights violations around the globe. I don't want to only confine myself and talk, we Armenians have suffered. Okay, you suffered, that's fine. But there are other people who are suffering around the globe, and you have to have a much larger picture and image and start doing comparative studies to understand the, you know, the situation.
Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, David.
You were just listening to Bedros Dermatosyan, Armenia, Artsakh, and Azerbaijan. I talked with him in mid-October. Bedros Dermatosyan is professor of modern Middle East history at the University of Nebraska at Lincoln. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are an independent, progressive nonprofit in our 38th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature voices rarely heard in the corporate media, such as Michael Parenti, Arundhati Roy, and Noam Chomsky. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Bedros Dermatosyan, Armenia, Artsakh, and Azerbaijan, just call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to Lucine Gasparian and to KGNU. Joe Ishii is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with Isabel Baydarakyan singing Grung, a classic Armenian song expressing separation and the longing for one's home. Oh.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Thank you for being.